In this edition of Generations, we talk to Olympia Gregory, a health specialist, about why the older generation seems to be hooked on vitamins and health supplements and whether they're really doing us any good. Plus, Dr. Laura Funk tells us more about the trend of living apart together from her research. And Judy Jenks from SeniorCentreCT.org joins us to discuss active aging, what it is and why we should be doing more of it. Hello, I'm Brian Scott-Smith and welcome to Generations, a new podcast for people of your generation. This episode is health related and we kick off with a discussion about the continued use of vitamins and supplements and why the older generation seem to be hooked on them more so than the younger people. It's a $37 billion unregulated industry with still no large-scale scientific evidence to suggest taking these pills and supplements actually does us any good. I caught up with Olympia Gregory, a qualified advanced practice registered nurse and founder of the Olympia Center for Women's Wellness, and asked her why, despite this lack of evidence, we continue to buy and consume these products.
There are a variety of reasons for why older Americans are taking vitamins at the rate at which they're taking. According to statistics, 46% of men take a vitamin every day and 54% of women take vitamins every day. And the research also shows that as age goes up and education goes up, as well as income, a greater percentage of those groups are taking vitamins as well. And I think that that's a very multifactorial process for understanding why they are doing that. So I've broken that down into various categories of why I think that may be the case. There are several factors for why more women take vitamins than men. And some of that may be rooted in the fact that during our childbearing years, we were recommended to take certain vitamins in order to have a healthy pregnancy and a healthy baby. And I think that some of that has actually just carried over as we've continued to age through the life cycle. And then the other thing is that women are always a little bit more interested in maintaining their health and trying to help to make sure that the family is eating well and trying to stay healthy as possible. And I think that for a certain percentage of the men who take vitamins, they may be taking a vitamin because their wives are putting them out every day and suggesting that they do so in order to stay healthy as well.
So do you think from your years of experience, we're just being captivated by the marketing of these things and the promises that they make?
I definitely think that there's part, that's maybe part of it as well. Because when we have a sensational study that comes out that says that a particular vitamin might do this, that, or the other, and we want that benefit for ourselves, then we're going to be more attracted to moving in that direction. Older adults are looking to stay healthy as long as possible, to stay young, looking and feeling as long as possible, and helping to prevent diseases. And in that quest for longevity and things like that, we're going to be more prone to being attracted to those things that seem to offer that.
Could it also be that we hear changes in medical and health science, but we've taken these for so long now because we get entrenched in our views that whatever we hear, we're just going to keep taking them anyway?
There was a time when all the research was saying that you must take omega-3s to prevent a heart attack or stroke. Subsequent research said that that may not be true. Now, for the people who started to take those vitamins early on, who are not at great risk, but they were really trying to be preventive in nature. They may still want to be taking them because they know that research, one year you're going to have something that's promoting a supplement, and 2 years from now, it may say something different. But in their own experience and in their own lives, they feel like it's still creating a benefit for them.
We're always being told to watch what we eat, and our diets do contain a lot of sugar, salt, fat, but the foods we eat are also fortified with vitamins. So apart from watching what we eat, do we really need these supplements?
Despite the fact that a lot of the food has been fortified with vitamins and minerals and nutrients and things like that, that it's still important to take some sort of supplementation. It may be minimal, but at least be aware of the potential need because, for example, a lot of the grain products have been fortified with the B vitamins, aren't well absorbed by the body. There are people who have food intolerances, genetic deficiencies and things like that, that prevent them from absorbing those particular nutrients from the food. Some sort of vitamin supplementation may be necessary.
So what sort of advice do you give people on matters like this that you think is beneficial?
Well, I'm a big believer that food should be our medicine, and that if we can eat a variety of good, clean, healthy food, then we may not need as much supplementation. However, when you look at our recommendations for what kinds of foods we should eat on a daily basis, for example, the RDA, or now with the MyPlate recommendations being put out by the federal government, many people find that it's impossible to actually follow those guidelines in detail. For example, something as simple as trying to get the nutrients from fish. We know that eating enough fish is probably going to be more beneficial than just taking a fish oil or omega-3 supplement. All of the nutrients that are also in the fish, including the protein, and as well as the other vitamins and minerals, iodine, things like that, that are still critically important for the body, they're not going to be in a fish oil tablet. And one of the things that's really important for people to understand, and I never recommend individual supplements unless there's a demonstrated need for that within my patient. So I'm not just going to say take some vitamin D if your vitamin D isn't low and you don't take vitamin D without the other nutrients that support it. But a lot of times when there's information in the media and marketing materials and things like that, one particular nutrient is being highlighted when in our bodies, all of those things work together. And the easiest way to obtain them and to absorb them properly would be to have the food from which that particular nutrient comes from.
Ultimately, Olympia, do you think people need to do more research about these items, as there's been a lot of controversy about what is really in some of these diet supplements, and also some of the vitamins we buy are packed with more filler than beneficial ingredients?
In general, people really should not take a whole lot of vitamins and nutrients without some sort of supervision. Supervision in terms of helping the individual to understand what his or her body needs, how they might be able to get that more efficiently through changing their diet and lifestyle.
My thanks to Olympia Gregory there. And if you want to find out more about her and her wellness center, visit her website at theolympiacenter.com. And if you need advice about vitamins and supplements, visit your doctor or speak to a qualified nutrition expert. Now, living apart together. It's a new option for older adults and seems to be growing in popularity. But what exactly is it? I spoke recently to Associate Professor of Sociology, Dr. Laura Funk, from the University of Manitoba in Canada, who's researched and written on the subject. Laura, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us, what exactly is living apart together?
As I understand it, living apart together relationships are a kind of a relatively new term used to describe two people that are in a long-term committed romantic relationship that decide to remain living in separate households rather than cohabit.
This is becoming more of an option for older adults. Why do you think they're taking this lifestyle choice?
So based on some of our research that I did with Dr. Karen Kobayashi at the University of Victoria, our understanding in terms of what we heard from some of the older participants in our study was that many of these people were in situations where they might have been divorced or widowed, and entering a new partnership after that came with sort of all this kind of previous emotional baggage, or even in some cases children and situations that made it more difficult to move in with someone else. For many of the women in these partnerships in particular, they also sought to put up some boundaries around some of the kind of typical caregiving type obligations in terms of even just cleaning up after someone else, that often women fall into that pattern. So for women in particular, it was a way of kind of protecting themselves and their independence, even though they very much loved the new person they were with.
What do the men and women in these relationships see as the benefits, though?
So they talked about it's not worth the gamble of moving in, so that living together was talked about as being kind of risky for the relationship because of the stresses and tensions involved in cohabiting. And sometimes this was a fear of recreating sort of past mistakes from previous relationships or things that they thought might have contributed to the breakdown of that previous partnership. And in fact, even beyond that, though, they felt that living apart actually more actively promoted the quality of relationships. That's that kind of that old adage that absence makes the heart grow fonder. And, you know, we don't take each other for granted is the kinds of things that people were telling us as well, that having these periods of missing each other actually made them appreciate the time they did have together and focus on making that quality time. Beyond those advantages, people also spoke a little bit more, less about the relationship and the benefits for the relationship, but also benefits for themselves personally. And so those would be things like, you know, I'm protected where I live and what I have. This idea that if I don't cohabit, I can protect myself from emotional harm that might be involved if I was to break up with someone in a cohabiting situation. Or, you know, I might have children living with me and I don't necessarily want to blend the family because it might harm the children. Or, you know, there's also all sorts of legal and financial entanglements that people get into sometimes when they cohabit that people maybe sought, again, for various reasons to protect themselves from. And then lastly, this idea of sort of protecting oneself just in the sense of I really at this stage of my life want my independence. I want that freedom in my daily routines, my habits, my ways of living. Financial decisions was a big one because living apart often entails maintaining separate financial accounts. So not, you know, having to be accountable to someone else to tell them how you spent your money.
So what are some of the negatives of LAT relationships?
There has been some concern with, you know, what happens down the road, particularly with aging couples, you know, when one of them actually needs like hands-on care. Some LAT participants in other studies have sort of said, you know, I still want to kind of protect myself from getting into a caregiving relationship. But ultimately, whenever you're in a long-term committed romantic partnership, whether you live together or not, you develop commitments to each other based on love. And so some of the other research that I've read shows that in fact, when it comes down to it, there really are exchanges of caregiving. Whether that means that one person has to then move in with the other, I know less about that, but certainly I think participants have a little bit of a sense of ambivalence about how that might happen down the road. Somebody might actually be going away for periods of time for work as well as not cohabiting. So they actually do miss their partner and sometimes feel lonely. You know, it's hard when that emotional support is not immediately available. They also spoke a little bit about practical challenges. So, you know, if you're going to one person's house for dinner, maybe you forgot an item that you needed that was back at your place and you need to run and go back and get it. So sort of that shuffling back and forth and having to have two of everything at different places. The most significant for many participants in LATs is this feeling of kind of the social, what would called the social stigma of LAT relationships, that they often felt that the others in their lives, their family and friends, really didn't get that they were in a committed romantic relationship, because there's this normal expected progression of things. You know, if you're dating someone, then it gets more serious, you move in together. But when that doesn't happen, it was hard for others in their social circles to understand that this still was a very committed relationship. And so they felt they didn't have, sometimes even the terminology, they didn't know about the LAT term, they felt they didn't have a way to express who this person was to them and talk about this person. And the terms girlfriend, boyfriend were almost not sort of significant enough, but they couldn't quite explain, didn't have the right terms to describe the relationship. So they got, you know, in some respects, sometimes judgmental comments from others, although at the same time, many people said, you know, I talked to some of my friends and they say, this is the best thing ever. I wish I could do that.
So another thing I want to ask you is about same-sex relationships. We're talking about a generation of people where, if they were gay, expressing that by way of living together wasn't socially acceptable. Do you think that the LAT situation has been partly fueled by situations like this?
One of the things we often wondered was whether historically, whether these kinds of relationship arrangements might actually have been occurring, yet not given the name LATs, that yet there was so little out there when we looked at this. There's very little research on it prior to the last decade, at least. The term only emerged like in the last several decades as well. But yet we constantly wondered, even as we were doing this research, you know, to what extent did this actually happen before in situations maybe where people did not want to sort of publicly make their relationship public, right, for various reasons. So certainly the example of gay couples and not wanting to kind of come out would be a good example.
My thanks to Dr. Laura Funk there from the University of Manitoba in Canada. And finally, Judy Jenks is back with us on Generations. How are you, Judy?
Very good.
Excellent. Good to have you back. So you've been looking into active aging. Tell us more about it.
I actually found it by accident. A friend told me to check out the website www.ageofmajority. And when I did, I found them using the term active ager. And they actually have the definition. So when I read it, it was like, wow. So here it is. What is an active ager? Young at heart and flush with cash. They're the tech-loving, gym-using, trend-setting, fun-seeking, fashion-shopping, car-buying, food-experimenting, age-consuming marketer's dream that your brand is ignoring. The active aging consumer spends $2.9 trillion on products and services a year, and they're craving the attention of the business owner.
Wow.
And I was astounded when I saw $2.9 trillion. And when we look at marketing, we look at the ads on TV and stuff, they're not advertising to this age group.
No, not at all.
Not at all. It's just absolutely astounding. And when you look around, when you go shopping, when you go anywhere and you look around, and if you were to start giving ages to people, I bet you you're going to give them a much younger age than they really are. Mm. Because seniors today are this active ager. They're out there. They're doing everything. They're learning the technology. They're buying the new fancy car that we wish we could be buying. And they're looking for all different ways to have fun, to vacation, to do everything. And so we need to start looking at seniors as the active ager. They're not stationary seniors. They're active agers.
Do you think part of the problem as well is, and I'm sure you'll get this as much as me, when you look back at your own parents and family when they were sort of our age, how much older they looked, and we don't actually look our age anymore. So I wonder,
exactly.
Is that like part of the problem? Is like it's actually trying to define who is a senior these
exactly.
days?
No, you really hit it, because I was a senior center director, as I've told you before, for over 30 years. And it used to be, and it probably was 20 years ago, when I saw a senior have their 80th birthday, for whatever reason, at that time, you could start to see the decline. Their mobility, their mental quickness, the things that they might be wanting to do, you could see that decline. Now it's not there anymore. You can meet somebody who is 90, and you're like, really? You would probably, if you were going to guess a 90-year-old's age, you probably would say they were probably in their early 70s.
Mm.
And so if the 90-year-old is in their early 70s, then the 70-year-old you'd probably think are in their 50s.
Mm.
My husband and I were on vacation. We went to a museum. I casually looked and saw and said to my husband, oh, we can do the senior discount. The woman that was taking the tickets argued with us that we were not seniors. So what a compliment is that?
Well, exactly.
Yes.
And we don't act our age either. And
no,
I know we say that to children, but, you know, older people don't act their age for the reasons we've just said, you know, and what you've just pulled up is we're staying active for longer.
Because we're healthier. And we take better care of ourselves. And we want to learn new things. There's so many new things that are happening all of the time that we want to do those too. Everybody wants to do those. I think of paddle boarding, you know, the longboards.
Mm.
Now, if you look at the people that are actually doing that, they're not in their 20s.
Mm.
They're not in their 30s. They're probably these active agers that are out there doing that. There's a kayak group down in, I think it's in the Waterford area, Groton area. And I would venture to guess the majority of them are active agers.
Talking about the paddle boarding, that brings me to a funny little story. I'm useless at windsurfing. I have tried it a few times in my past, and I just don't seem to have the balance for it. So paddle boarding sounds like it could be for me.
Perhaps it is.
So what else did you find out about the active aging? This is a huge subject.
So if you go to Age of Majority's website, there is all sorts of data there. This company exists solely to help other companies market to the active ager. The older population is very willing to change brands. We have a tendency to think that just because you've always bought whatever, you're not going to buy anything else. Well, they will, and they have $2.9 trillion to spend. So don't think because you have the new product, they're not going to look at it.
See, again, that is really interesting because, you know, we do seem to get a little bit entrenched in our views. Uh-huh. And it is often said, you know, the older we get, you know, we'll stick with something that we know. But basically, that obviously isn't the case.
No, it's not. And 40% of all spending is done by people 50 and older. 40%.
That's huge.
It is.
And we've just seen, obviously, the figure as well in the billions, because obviously, you know, if they've had
children.
Trillions, sorry, mm-hmm. Yeah. So if they've had children, of course, you know, the children have grown up, you know, they've moved on, mm-hmm. probably got families of themselves. So the disposable income has gone up. I mean, despite the fact it is expensive, you know, to live these days. But, I mean, clearly the money is there.
Oh, it is. It is. And now the companies need to start looking at who their marketing people are, educating those marketing people of this population, and now start advertising to them more directly. And they need to look at how we use things. You and I have talked about Alexa.
Mm.
Well, I finally did get Alexa, and I also got the Amazon Fire Stick.
How are your potatoes, before you tell us? Because
I have used it as a timer more times than you can guess. I used it as an alarm to get me here on time today.
There we go.
So that and music are my two favorite things. But the Amazon Fire Stick, I got the voice-activated one. So we can ask the TV to play what we want. And so if you look at those kinds of things, and we're going to, you know, we all tell each other, oh, guess what I got and what I'm doing, and so it's going to grow. Don't underestimate who your market is.
Oh, absolutely, because, I mean, that's always the thing, isn't it? You know, if you like something, you'll tell somebody.
Exactly.
And word of mouth is one of the most powerful pieces of marketing that anybody can have.
Yes, it is.
Excellent stuff. Well, Judy, ever so many thanks.
Thank you very much.
We'll catch you, obviously, in the next episode. That's all from this edition of Generations. Don't forget to visit seniorcentrect.org to find out what's going on in your neck of the woods. And if you want to send us a topic to talk about or want to be our guest on the podcast, drop us a line by visiting the seniorcentrect.org website. Go to the bottom of the homepage and click the How to Advertise with Us link to get in touch. From myself, Brian Scott-Smith, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.